I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Andy Norman, author of Mental Immunity, and Melanie Tresick King, creator of Thinking is Power. And they are co-founders of the Mental Immunity Project. And you can learn more at mentalimmunityproject.org. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, .net. So I'm going to be talking today with a couple of the leaders of the Mental Immunity Project, which aims, as they say, to reduce the public susceptibility to bad information, extremism, pseudoscience, conspiracy theories, propaganda, and more, by equipping them with the skills they need to identify and to reject misleading or manipulative content. Now, here's how they describe the problem and their solution briefly. Social media and AI let bad actors weaponize information, and their output is stressing the world's democracies as never before. And I would say not just their democracies, but their relationships, their communities, their health, all sorts of things. Yep. And to meet this growing threat, we, that is human society, have two options. Find a way to stop the lies, or find a way to stop people from believing them. Now, the former, as we all know, is pretty near impossible in a free society, but there turns out there's solid evidence that the latter is achievable. The brain, researchers have found, has an immune system that fights off misinformation the way the body fights off pathogens. The trick is to help it function well, and that's what the project is about. The science of cognitive immunology has big implications, they say, for our unhealthy information ecosystem. The onslaught of bad information won't end, but we can bolster our resistance to it, and I love this line. Lies are a lot less destructive when people don't believe. Andy Norman is the author of Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. The founder of the Cognitive Immunology Research Collaborative, CIRCE, a global institute dedicated to combating disinformation. Norman's work has appeared in Scientific American, Psychology Today, and The Humanist, among others. And he's appeared on NPR and The Joe Rogan Experience, which not that many people can probably say that. That's like when I would have people that were published in The Conservative and The Nation. You know, I think that's always a good sign. Melanie Tresick King is the creator of Thinking is Power, an online critical thinking resource. She's also an associate professor of biology at Massasoit Community College, where she teaches a science course designed to teach critical thinking and information and science literacy. And along with Lee McIntyre, who is not with us today, they are, I said co-founders, it seems Andy's actually the original founder, but they're kind of pretty upstream in this organization and share the leadership at this point. And as I said, and we'll repeat a few more times, you can learn more at mentalcommunityproject.org. And for Melanie's work, you can look at thinkingispower.com. Okay, welcome Andy Norman and Melanie Tresick King to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terrence. It's a pleasure to be here. That was a masterful introduction. Beautifully done.
Thank you, sir.
Agreed. And thank you.
And I'm going to tell listeners we're recording this conversation Wednesday, February 21st. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. I often say to people, I'm not interviewing your book or your project. It's you. So what I want you to do is both of you, in your own words, tell us how you see your path to the life you lead, the work you do. And you can go way back, childhood inspirations, turning points, mentors, that sort of thing. And I don't want you to go heavily into this project, because the evolution of this project we will get into in a little bit. Okay? Melanie, how about first?
Oh, wow. So I was born in, just kidding.
Start at the beginning.
I said go way back.
Okay, so my origin story. I, for a very long time, over 10 years, taught a general education biology course at a community college. And I love teaching gen ed science because it's the last educational experience most people are going to have with science for the rest of their lives. And I love biology. I'm a biologist, but I kept thinking, is this really helping students? And so at some point I asked myself, if I had one semester to teach the average person what they needed to know about science and about how we know things and how to find good information, what would that look like? And it was not what I was teaching. So I created a course to replace it to teach skills, not facts. The skills are critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy. And through the process, I created Thinking is Power. The idea being, you know, we carry access to basically all of humanity's knowledge in our pockets, but also the misinformation. The question is, when you need information, can you find reliable information and think about it in a way that helps you make better decisions? And so I started Thinking is Power. Knowledge is not enough, right? So thinking is power. And in my classroom, I use pseudoscience and misinformation and conspiracy theories and fake news and so on to teach what real information, what reliable information looks like. How else can we help students see the good stuff without seeing the bad stuff? And also, this is how Andy and I connected. I didn't realize what I was doing, but I was having my students create misinformation in class to help inoculate them against misinformation in the real world. And I saw Andy's, his book had come out about that time, and we connected on social media, and I suppose the rest is history.
Which we'll get into. But I find it interesting, actually, that this is not a long-standing relationship. It really was your sort of your individual quests or missions found each other.
Yeah. It's been, we're having a lot of fun working together on these things, but we each have a significant story to tell about how we got even to that point. So maybe this is the time for me to mention mine. So I come from a long line of educators, and I think just hanging out with my parents and my grandparents made me really care passionately about teaching. And then as an undergraduate, I remember reading a quote from Einstein basically saying something like, you know, our technological powers have skyrocketed, and the challenge of the next generation is to develop the wisdom to wield it, you know, good, basically. And I was just struck by the idea that our wisdom has not kept pace with our cleverness, and how hugely disruptive that can be. And so I decided to study philosophy so that I could understand how to help people become wiser. And I was struck by a thought at the time, like, what if we could make everybody in the world like 10% wiser through a better education? I actually believe we could utterly transform our world if everybody was just that much wiser, or to put it the other way around, that much less foolish.
Half cup is half full or half empty, right?
we can do it that way. That's right. I spent a lot of years looking at how philosophers have been trying to promote wisdom and realizing that they've failed to create wisdom en masse. I think there are a few times in history where Western civilization got substantially smarter, like the Scientific Revolution, for example, the Enlightenment. Our hopes that our civilization in general would become much wiser, you know, top to bottom, have really not been fulfilled. So I've started thinking about, should there be a science about how thinking works to weed out the bad ideas? And that science ought to be able to inform our efforts to become wiser and to help each other become wiser. So that was the motivation to write my book. And I've named the science of mental immunity, cognitive immunology, and it's studying how the mind filters information so that we can all get better at it.
Mm-hmm. In other words, there are people on the physical side that study inoculation.
The body's immune system.
The immune system that study inoculation. And I would, one thing I have noticed is that obviously when you are asked to sort of defend the existence of this, that one of your approaches is metaphorical.
Yeah. Well, when you propose that the mind has an immune system, almost everybody experiences that as metaphorical at first. I think I'm gradually winning over a lot of my scholarly colleagues to the view that it's not just a metaphor, that there's something profoundly right about that, and that we can probably derive a lot of useful information from running with the metaphor.
Right. But I wouldn't mind you laying out the metaphor first so people can begin to play with it in their minds. And then, so I'm gonna make it a two-parter, which is always hell because people always go, what was that second part? So the metaphor first, you know, pathogens here, pathogens there, that sort of thing. And then I've seen you say that more and more credible people are saying, there might be something here. This might be real, right? That you have noticed since you wrote the book, how many years ago? 21?
Yeah, 21. So almost
21.
Four. Almost
so you're 3 years into this, and you've also been working on this organization. So you've gotten a lot of feedback. The people who disagree or the people who are coming around, what are some of the things they say? So first the metaphor, and then what are some people's reactions?
Yeah. About 6 decades ago, a psychologist named William McGuire discovered that you can expose minds to weakened doses of bad information and thereby induce resistance to stronger or more dangerous versions of that same information. So the mind actually seems to generate manufacture antibodies if you expose it to the bad information or the bad arguments in the right way. So he called this psychological inoculation, and he discovered that, I mean, basically, here's what you do. You provide somebody with the reasons to doubt something, and then next time they encounter something similar doubts pop into their minds, and they're a little more skeptical. So doubts are, in a way, the antibodies of the mind, and we can learn to, just as we can train the body's immune system to create, say, COVID antibodies, we can train the mind to generate doubts about conspiracy theories, say.
Well, or we can allow the mind to entertain doubts about the COVID vaccine. And that's something else you'll talk about. But yes, you're dealing right with the metaphor. It's just when you go to that one, it's so obvious where it's gone both ways.
Yeah. So I want to push this metaphor hard and see how much we can extract from it. And so I've just written co-authored an article for a scholarly research magazine arguing that for all intents and purposes, minds really do have immune systems, literally. I think that my arguments are sound, but of course, it's going to take time to win people over on that. And I've got some wonderfully smart colleagues, Melanie among them, who aren't so sure that I should take this metaphor literally. And so maybe we should ask her. Melanie, you have some the metaphor. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it lays on the definition of what an immune system is. And so the body's immune system has recognizable cells that coordinate a response to a pathogen. And we're talking about psychological inoculation, and it's not empirical in that sense where you can identify the actual biochemical or cellular processes. But in my mind, it is an incredibly useful metaphor. So if I go into a classroom, because I'm an educator, right? So if I go into a classroom and I tell my students I want them to think critically about something, critical thinking itself has lots of different definitions. What does that mean, right? And how do you do it? But if I tell them, for example, that the mind, if you imagine that the mind has an immune system, that certain ideas can hijack your brain's ability to think critically through things, and that it's about developing a strong filter for bad ideas, not letting those in to hijack those processes, then to me, the metaphor is useful enough that it doesn't even have to be literal to be useful.
I had a sense that's where you were going. And I have seen you say, Andy, that even those who disagree with the concrete reality of the immune system see the need for utilizing the metaphor to equip people, right?
Yeah, I like to say that the set of concepts that have been worked out by immunologists turn out to be surprisingly useful for thinking about thinking, basically. And that just everyday lay thinkers can learn these concepts and become better thinkers. So we can all benefit from this metaphor. But I actually also think that psychologists themselves, people who study the mind, cognitive scientists, are going to discover all kinds of interesting things if they lean hard on the metaphor and actually entertain the possibility that it might actually be true in some literal sense.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say a couple of things. In something I read, AI-governed algorithms amplify information with viral properties, and our connectedness makes us more vulnerable to sketchy information. Here I'm going a little bit deeper into the problem. We've been talking about the solution or the foundation for the solution. And our ability to spot nonsense has not kept pace with our ability to spread it.
Yes.
Great line.
Thank you.
It made me think that the same could be said for the physical world, that our ability to defend against toxins or something like climate change has not kept pace with our ability to spread or expand those.
Mm.
And I think that's one of our biggest challenges as a society.
Yeah, and there's a historical case that's relevant here. When a lot of country dwellers moved to the cities in the 19th century to work in factories and so on, disease started spreading like crazy because, you know, the social distance was less, right? When you're living in cramped quarters with others, it's much easier to contract the illnesses that they bear. Disease became a real public health priority in the 19th and early 20th century. And it led to the discovery of the body's immune system and some tremendously powerful and beneficial developments, especially the development of the smallpox vaccine, right? Diphtheria vaccine. Vaccines have saved literally billions of lives. And it was because science rose to the challenge and gave us a solution to our heightened susceptibility that came with urban living. Now we have this giant interconnected digital world where the social distance that information has to travel to infect new minds is very, very small. And we're seeing the infodemics, epidemics of misinformation spread across the internet in scary ways. And I think it's time we helped our ability to spot and shed nonsense catch up to our ability to create and spread it.
Yeah. Let me jump to you, Melanie. When you're dealing with students, and this is community college, correct? Yeah. So they're young, except for the returning veterans and the people returning to the system, you know, all praise to them and all support to them. What are their reactions to this notion of the metaphor, of the building of a response system?
Yeah, so I love teaching at a community college. I often think of my students as lovingly the normals. So if you imagine like a bell curve, on one end of the bell curve are people that really don't need me. And on the other end are people that are very difficult to reach, especially with my time and skill set. But there's a vast majority of people who are in varying levels of knowledge about these concepts. And most of them just don't know. And I use a lot of inoculation activities with them, but I don't necessarily use the mental immunity metaphor. I don't even think it's necessary in the classroom. So what I'll do with them is exercises to inoculate them against various forms of misinformation, and they have a wonderful time doing it, and it's very effective, and it's engaging, and it works. So
who cares what you call it?
Yeah.
Well, Melanie's doesn't do enough to toot her own horn on this. She has some just brilliant learning activities where kids work in groups to create their own conspiracy theories, for example. And in the process, they, you know, they have fun trying to snooker each other and create belief systems that have all the properties of conspiracy theories. And they come out of it really understanding how conspiracy theories work and far less susceptible to them. It's wonderful stuff.
I get that. Given the assignment, develop a conspiracy theory. What would it be linked to? Where would it start? How would you spread it? Who would your target audience be?
Who's conspiring and why? Yep.
You get done with that and you're way ahead of the game.
Yeah. And importantly, the ingredients here are to start with non-triggering examples. If I start with, for example, the FDA is hiding a cure for cancer, right? If I start with something like that, polls show like 40% of Americans believe that. I mean, you don't want to check me out. It's a lot of people who believe that. So I'm immediately going to trigger certain students. And so I don't. I start with birds aren't real. I don't know if you know this conspiracy theory. It's satire and it's hysterical. It's not meant to be real, but they use the same kind of logic, I'm air quoting, behind conspiracy theories, where all evidence points to the conspiracy. So what I have my students do is I teach them how conspiracy works. I give them this satirical example. And then I say, okay, make your own. Use humor, make it funny, right? Tell me who did what and why. Find evidence for it. So they have to go online and find evidence. Again, I'm scare quoting again. So their evidence, they're hysterical because it doesn't take very long before somebody raises their hand and goes, Professor, do I need to use reliable sources? I'm like, no. I mean, what conspiracy theorist uses reliable sources? Find a YouTube video or a subreddit or whatever it is.
What
I don't
kind
care.
Of upstanding conspiracy would limit itself that way. Yes.
Perfectly said.
Okay, find anything. It doesn't matter. And then I put them with another group and I say, okay, explain your conspiracy to the other group. But the other group has to try and disprove your conspiracy. Well, have you thought of this? Here's why this is wrong. Well, but there's this evidence. And they have to maintain the conspiracy in face of those attempts to disprove it, which is, I'm scare quoting again, the brilliance of conspiracy theories. That's how they work, is they're immune to evidence. All evidence is used to support the conspiracy. So they learned this motivated reasoning tactic, the cherry picking, the confirmation bias, the ways to always justify what it is that their claim was. And then they see it in their real world. I often joke, this is what's called active inoculation. So they create their own misinformation. And in the process, they create their own antibodies to that misinformation. It's like a magic trick, right? So if you were to show a kid a magic trick, then the kid could think it's magic if you didn't tell them. Well, you could explain, well, that's not magic. But there's nothing like doing the magic trick yourself. So there's an awesome Mark Twain quote. It says, if you hold a cat by the tail, you learn things you can't learn any other way. So by doing, they recognize it. And that's the active inoculation process.
That's great, Millie. I love that Mark Twain quote. It's so, you know, I think a great line like that is where the beginning doesn't tell you the end, you know? It's like holding cat by the tail, you have no idea where he's going, but then you get there.
Yeah. And it's better than you thought.
That's why he's Mark Twain and we're not, you know? I wanted to read a quote and just throw you a question. And I'm going to be bouncing, I think, a little bit around because I've got so many notes and questions, but I looked at your vision for the Mental Immunity Project, a world where enhanced immunity to problematic information substantially improves the prospects of all, just as enhanced immunity to infectious diseases dramatically improved human prospects in the 19th and 20th century. And it occurred to me that if what we're singling out here is misinformation and disinformation and at some level ignorance, but you know, ignorance in the face of information, etc., that doesn't solve, you know, how much better could society be in 5 to 10 years if we really were good at that? And it struck me, it doesn't solve the greed problem, if you will. In other words, I think inequality of opportunity as well as of wealth and of all sorts of things are what has led to a lot of our polarization and thus inhibits or dooms our, you know, our movement forward. And so the people who know, the people behind a lot of the disinformation know it's disinformation, but the greed that they use to drive it. So you get where people are better at filtering it out. It still won't solve the greed problem, but I guess what it does is it helps hopefully significant numbers of people less susceptible to the manipulation by the greedy. Would that be?
Yeah, that seems right to me. I don't imagine that mis and disinformation are upstream of greed, for example. So,
and there's little that's upstream of greed.
I mean, but I can easily imagine. I can weave a story right where certain things that are taught in business schools actually give people permission to be greedy, and thereby express more greed than they might not than they might otherwise. I mean, that's just a story at the moment. But I do think that mis and disinformation and the misbeliefs they give rise to are upstream of a whole lot of social problems. Polarization, our inability to work together to solve some of our nation's priorities. When bad information starts getting slung around in a hyper-partisan way, I mean, we've watched in the last 10 years or so how our nation's ability to work on its problems has degraded precipitously, precisely because so many people are susceptible to false narratives, conspiracy theories, extremism of one kind or another. I think if we could somehow make humanity, say, 10% less susceptible to all of these things, I think our world could be twice as, we could turn our world, make it 10 times.
I was going to say twice as able in a way.
Maybe that's the word
We would have greater capacity to actually deal with challenges in at the root of a lot of my conversations for the last couple of years are the notion that the unfettered market, or more accurately, one that writes its own rules based on political money, is unequipped to solve the actual biggest challenges we face. Climate change, our relationship with the rest of nature, inequality, tribalism, public health and pandemics, and endangered democracy.
Yeah.
Those are the things I see that we need to solve, and those are the things which I think are rendered impossible in the current system. But I think, you know, I see you're nodding because I think the diminishment of misinformation or the power of disinformation would help us in all of those.
Okay. Yeah. I think the very fact that you invited us to be on the show implied that you kind of got that aspect of what we're trying to do, and I'm thrilled that you want to share that with your listeners, because I think if we work together on mitigating this particular source of misery and division, I think we can do a huge amount to better our world.
And in some sense, if we cooperate on one thing, if we get better at collaborating, if we get better at listening, the positive feedback loops, and I'm sure you've thought about this is why you're dedicating your lives to this, but the positive feedback loops of one experience of collaboration, one experience of understanding, one experience of changing your mind, I think is where the real magic is.
And it can snowball, right?
Let me ask you a little bit about the evolution of, in other words, the way I see it, and you can both speak to this. You might start first, Andy, because, okay, there's the mental immunity idea, then the mental immunity book, then there's Searcy, then there's a panel, then there's a declaration, then there's a pledge, there's thinking is power, there's you two, there's Lee McIntyre, and then there's the project. So talk a little bit about that story.
Yeah. So when my book came out, I started rubbing elbows with some really smart people who were working on more or less the same problem. And a lot of them said, there's a lot of power in this metaphor of mental immunity. You know, we should be working, Andy, you should found an institute and make it a thing. And I didn't have anything better to do, so why not? gave it a go, but I asked Melanie and a number of other leading thinkers in this field to become part of a, we called it a blue ribbon panel, just to kind of sound to make it sound important. But we spent a summer talking about our world's mis- and disinformation problem and the best way to address it. And the really wonderful thing that came out of it was a consensus among the participants on the panel that mitigating our susceptibility to mis- and disinformation by boosting our immunity to it could really be a powerful lever in this. So we issued a joint declaration that has since been signed by over 100 scholars and experts, basically saying this is a lever point that could help us adapt to this wacky new digital world, brave new digital world we've created. And it needs to be made a priority at the policy level. We need more funding for the science. We need more efforts to build these discoveries into curricula and, you know, the way in which children are taught. And it all kind of went from there.
One thing I hear there, by the way, is that there's sort of two tracks you can be on. One is more scientific research. You know, in other words, here's an idea, here's some alleged solutions, let's test those and see how they work. Yes. But the other was, it seemed to me, at the same time they said, but we don't have to wait until proven. And this is sort of, Melanie, this goes back to your response, right? Was, I don't have to absolutely become a believer to be a user.
We know enough already, I think, to start making a difference on this. And I'm not sure we have the luxury of to wait around on it either.
And the declaration sort of made that point. It's, we're working to establish how true this is, but we can see right now there's levers of power to use.
Yes.
And then, so you have the book, the ideas, the panel, the declaration, there's a pledge. Who makes that pledge? Who signs that pledge? Who's that pledge for?
This was the brainchild of a young colleague of ours, who's a wonderful, wonderful collaborator. His idea was that anybody who cares about critical thinking might want to sign a mental immunity pledge, which is basically saying, hey, let's take critical thinking to the next level by doing these simple things that enhance mental immune function. And so the pledge is based on sort of 10 principles that Melanie and I hammered out together, working together really intensely over 6 months. But we tried to come up with sort of 10 simple habits of mind that can help make your mind substantially more immune to the bad stuff. You can learn about those 10 principles on our website. Melanie's recorded marvelously engaging videos explaining each one.
That's right. Really, so there's 10 principles, 10 videos.
Yeah. And if you like what we're trying to do there and think it this should become a movement of kinds and want to lend your name to the cause, you can just click over to the pledge and add your name.
So it's for anyone who visits. And Melanie, I can see where Andy's come up with this big idea and they told him go start an institute. What your practice had already been was trying to make what you were trying to do, like thinking and better thinking, user friendly.
Yes.
And nobody is better at this than Melanie. I'm convinced the.
I will say, by the way, I go to lots of websites, obviously, preparing for, you know, all these conversations, and the number of available videos, available means, available pithy sayings and so on were just great. And I will tell you a slight digression here, which is that I have a file that I call birthday quotes. And it's my favorite set of quotes. And when I see someone on Facebook has a birthday, I'll go see what ones might fit them, right? And let me just throw you just a few, because I'm going to email them to you because they fit what you guys are doing. They'll be on your little plaques.
All right.
To attain knowledge, add things every day. To attain wisdom, remove things every day. That's Lao Tzu.
That's Lao Tzu, really?
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay,
when you're cool. finished changing, you're finished. Benjamin Franklin.
Nice.
The cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity.
Love it.
Doris Lessing. This is what learning is. You suddenly understand something you've understood all your life, but in a new way. Okay? You can, Mahfuz, you can tell whether a man is clever by his answers. You can tell whether a man is wise by his questions. John Wooden, it's what you learn after you know it all that counts.
These are wonderful.
Einstein, the most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is the sense of the mysterious. That reminds me of Iris DeMent, the country singer's song about religion, Let the Mystery Be. Mm-hmm. I see you nodding. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but whenever anyone says to me, so where were you on religion? I say, this song says it. Mm-hmm. Melody.
I am a sucker for a good quote. So those were amazing.
And Socrates, who you point to as, you know, wisdom begins in wonder. Basically the same thing as what Einstein was saying.
You may enjoy some of the quotes I assemble and use as chapter headings in my book, Terrence, because I found a couple dozen and sprinkled them throughout. And I use a couple of the ones you mentioned.
Oh, excellent.
There's some more that I think you'll like there.
Very, very good. Yeah, in preparing for this, actually, I didn't get sent your book. But I would love to, you know.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I should. There was an element of your question to Melanie a minute ago that I wanted to give her another shot at. I'm a philosopher by training. I'm something of a theoretician, but Melanie has a wonderful sense of how to put these ideas into practice. And quite apart from her ability to create fun memes that stick in your mind and help you think better.
And make it easier for you to spread.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But only the good stuff. Never the bad stuff.
But you were going to say you had a...
Well, just, I think Melanie's story about how she teaches kids to think about conspiracy theories is an example. But she's developing comparable active learning activities to strengthen the mind's immune system in half a dozen other ways. And I think that a combination of those learning activities, I imagine a future where every kid had an immune system that could function a cognitive immune system that functions 10% better because they played some fun games in a class like Melanie's. That's the world I look really, really look forward to living in, and hope I can stick around long enough to experience it.
Right. I was going to say, Melanie, if you would, take two or three of the 10 principles and kind of tell people what that looks like.
Oh, to me, one of the most important principles, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't remember exactly how we said it,
sure.
Is about holding our beliefs loosely. It's very difficult to be objective about a claim or a belief when we are attached to it, when our identity... So the part of our brain that gets triggered by a physical threat becomes triggered by a threat to that belief. And so we're not interested in the truth. We're interested in defending the belief.
Survival.
Yeah. And so, and it's our ego at stake. And especially one step further when it's our tribal identity at stake. I mean, humans for, most of our history lived in small groups where they were our source of survival. We needed them to survive, and they protected us against them. But in order for there to be an us, there has to be a them. And so humans are naturally tribal. The problem is that we often look to our tribe for truth, but they're not necessarily the best source of truth. But when our tribal allegiance is on the line, we defend that claim because we don't want to risk losing our standing in our group. that means social death. There's Brooke Harrington, the social psychologist, and I'm paraphrasing again, but something like, if there's an E equals MC squared of social psychology, it's that tribal death is worse than physical death. Mm-hmm. We don't want to risk losing our social group. And so recognizing that we are not our beliefs, and that instead of being a part of a tribe that is based on a shared identity or shared belief, a group that's based on shared inquiry, of wanting to learn, of testing ideas, of not being afraid to be wrong, actually of rewarding changing our minds.
Yeah, I think something I wrote down that one of you said was, join a community of inquisitive folks, stay humble, and seek shared understanding. And and you talk a lot about this, the role of doubt and the role of question. And I will say that one thing that made me little tap myself on the back was that I have noticed, and it's funny, it's like over the last year or two, I'm more often, when I finish declaring something, say, you know, I may be wrong. And I'm not sure how I developed that, but why it started happening. But I know it's like, I think I found myself reading so much, you know, that it's like you even said, you know, when you paraphrased both of those, you said, I'm paraphrasing. I mean, you know, it's that sort of thing of, there's just too much information for me to be sure everything I say is accurate.
Well, and one thing you learn early on, if you start to study philosophy, is that you should sort of keep track of the things you approve of, you, things you believe in and are willing to assent to, things you accept. But you should also simultaneously keep track of why you believe or accept things, and also keep a sense of, well, just how firmly do I hold this? If you only think something is 85% true, then qualify the claim by saying, I think this is true, pretty sure, but, right? So I think the most responsible thinkers use that kind of look, they look over their own shoulder at their own beliefs and offer a more objective, detached perspective also, which can help to mitigate some of the worst deformations of thought to which human beings are prone.
Yeah, go ahead, Melanie.
Yeah, if I might, because gosh, choosing my favorite 10 principles is just like, it's a really hard thing to do because I'm attached to all of them, apparently.
You're attached to your principles. Oh,
no, I know. But one of them is of the avoiding black or white thinking and overconfidence and being comfortable with not being certain. I'm going to paraphrase again. Daniel Kahneman, who was once asked if he had a magic wand that could rid the world of one bias, what would it be? And he said, overconfidence. Like, if we're overconfident, we can't learn. And so I always at this point try to think of my beliefs on a spectrum. You know, if my husband and I are arguing over something, I'll say, I don't know, I'm like 90% sure I said that, right? Well, could I be wrong? Yeah, I could be wrong. Yeah. But that first, that actually just putting a number on it, proportioning it, helps to mitigate extremism, because in avoiding the actual 0 and 100. So put yourself someplace and then allow yourself to move on that spectrum of confidence.
Anything less than 100 is gray, right? I mean, to some extent, yeah. And one thing I wanted to say was that those 10 principles, and I'll say a few of them because I wrote them down, but I think some of them are sort of like, kind of, if you can go through life behaving this way, but a lot of them kind of work if you've been introduced to some new information. If someone has given, you know, if something, and it may be that something's attractive to you even, oh, now that's an explanation, that makes it, that those 10 principles are, to some extent, a set of criteria to run that through.
Yes.
Monitor your motives. Why might you, is it for social status that you want to believe this? Is it going to get you impress the boss, impress your partner or your potential partner? Mind your emotions. See where your emotions come into this. Examine your reasons. And I think that gets to sort of, you know, what are my reasons and how much, you know, how much of that is driven by that sort of thing. And the three that I thought were the most fascinating sort was explore why you might be wrong. And it's not just like consider you might be wrong, but explore it. What if I were wrong about this, why would that be? What is it in my past? What is it in my current situation? And then embrace subtractive learning. That goes back to that Lao Tzu quote, right? Mm-hmm. And so, Melanie, what is subtractive learning?
Well, you know what? I'm going to pass this off to Andy because subtractive learning was
That's really subtractive.
It's brilliant.
I like to say that, I mean, it felt to me growing up and coming through the public school system that I was being treated like a knowledge receptacle. It felt like day after day after day, people were just trying to heap information into my head, pile knowledge into my head. And when I finally got to college and got to start questioning all the crap that had built up there and realizing I could part with some of it, I thought, you know, subtractive learning is as important as additive learning. Learning isn't all just about adding to the mind's knowledge stockpile. It's also like whittling away the stuff that doesn't belong. It's more like sculpting than
yeah.
Right?
And that's that definition of sculpting that we get from Michelangelo, right? You take away everything that isn't David and you're left with David. You guys know the book by Lydie Klotz called Subtraction?
No.
Oh, yeah. I've interviewed him and I'll send you a link or drop me a note that says, remember you said you'd send me that link.
All right.
But what he looks at is in all, not just in ideas, but in architecture, in problem solving. In problem solving, our usual response is we add something. That's
yes.
when you give people, and I'm sure Melanie, when you give people a problem to solve, their likely first impulse of how to make it better is to add something. And so his book is about psychological scientific experiments that have actually shown the value and the power of subtraction.
Subtracting. Fascinating. That's a wonderful generalization of the idea. I love it.
And then this notion of play for team truth. And I think that's one that's kind of a tricky one. In other words, I'm going to paraphrase your whole approach here and say that what you're saying as an aim is the Goldilocks approach. If your mental immune system is lax, weak, you'll allow yourself to think garbage and pass it on. If your mental immune system becomes overreactive and you lose trust and you don't trust the government and you don't trust the church and you don't trust your friends, then you become your likelihood of becoming a conspiracy theorist goes way up because you are hypercritical. It's like an autoimmune disease, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So this play for team truth, someone can certainly respond and say, I'm team truth. You know, that's exactly what I'm doing. You've fallen for the mainstream garbage, but I think actually my sense of conspiracy people who buy into is that that's what they actually think they're doing
so you can seize on the notion of truth and just paste it onto whatever opinion you favor and say I'm team truth. But what real thinkers do, what scientists do, is they use the word truth mostly in the following way: that's interesting, comma, but is it true? So they use it to raise the question of whether to initiate an inquiry that tests the idea. And it's that we want. So imagine belonging to a tribe that has a certain ideas about, I don't know, race, and encountering another tribe that has very different ideas about race, and imagining a conflict emerging. Wouldn't you want the partisans on the other side to set aside their prejudices and acknowledge the truths you're trying to make? You would, right? If you want them to do that for you, then you have to do that also for them. You have to be willing to set aside your partisan opinions for the truths that might emerge in the course of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I were to add, a conspiratorial thinking is really dangerous for that very reason. It's enticing because believers in conspiracy theories feel like they hold some sort of special knowledge that everybody else doesn't have. And, you know, there's there are various personality traits that are associated with conspiratorial thinking, amongst them things like narcissism high need for certainty. But the problem is that conspiratorial thinking, like we said earlier, it is impervious to actual evidence. When I talk to conspiratorial thinkers, here's the thing. They will say, but there are conspiracies, right? Like we know, for example, that, you know, the United States government did conspire in the Tuskegee experiments. There was a conspiracy by Volkswagen, for example. There have been conspiracies, but we know about those because we have evidence. So if we actually want to find conspiracy theories, then we need to use critical thinking. Conspiratorial thinking won't help us actually uncover conspiracies. So the conspiratorial believer thinks that they are onto this like special knowledge and it feels empowering, but it's a false sense of empowerment. So
by the way, I think that where we were talking before about you run into trouble when you identify with your beliefs. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things going on here is you identify with my in crowd, my tribe knows what's really going on. And your identity becomes not even a specific belief, mm-hmm. but that notion that you're the ones who, you know, who have done the research and who know. And isn't it sad that everyone else is being duped and you wish you could help them, but some people just are beyond, you know, all that sort of thing. But I think it's the identity of a better knowledge. How do you deal with faith and religion in this? Because it seems to me, to a fair extent, religion is about identifying with beliefs and sharing beliefs and tribal, you know. I mean, you probably, I'm just going to throw another thing out there. Robert Wright's book, Non-Zero, you know, sure. Where he says.
Big fan of
that. We're moving in that direction. We're moving in that. Whoops. And that the greatest time when we identify, when we overcome tribal things is when we find another tribe. I mean, in other words, in war, suddenly. You know, as people have said to people, if aliens invaded, would the red and blue states unite? You know, that sort of thing. So, but how do you deal with faith and religion?
Yeah. So there's now some pretty good empirical research that suggests that people who refuse to update religious beliefs when new evidence comes in, that can damage a person's ability to think in an open-minded way about other things. Mm. So if you're dogmatic in a religious space, it can spill over and make you more dogmatic about a conspiracy theory. It can make you more prone to extremism. So, you know, I know that people of faith are trying to capture something good with their concept of faith. And I mean, trust, the concept of faith is a close cousin to the concept of trust. And trust is a hugely important and valuable thing. And hope, and that good, there's the other one. So I sympathize with people of faith who celebrate faith because they intuit correctly that it can induce trust and hope into our lives. I just think there are better ways to do it, ways that don't simultaneously promote closed-mindedness. And I really don't like it when the concept of faith is used to justify dogmatic attachment to belief, because it's not healthy for the believer themselves, and it's not healthy for our larger society if we cling dogmatically to beliefs. If we want to make a civil society, we all need to be willing to put our beliefs on the line when we converse with others. If I want you to be willing to rethink your views, I need to put my own beliefs on the line and give you a chance to change mine.
Yeah, I'm going to throw you one other thing that had been in my mind. Then we're basically at the end of the hour. I'll let that be kind of your last, Andy. I'm going to throw in this one thing and then Melanie, you know, a closing thought. And that is that Don Ingber, who is a scientist and the founding director of an institute at Harvard and a brilliant guy. He made a distinction that I hadn't even thought of. He said, you know, science is not a thing. It is not the accumulation of what science has learned. It is not the science is a process. You can, and when anyone says follow the science, that doesn't mean follow yesterday's facts even. It means follow the science, which is a verb, and it's a verb of exploration. Someone else in the last week, and I certainly thought of this as I was preparing this, said when we can shift from defend to discover, which I think is just a great way of putting it in any interaction, you know, in anything we're doing with another. So Melanie, your last thought, and then I'll have to close. I will say, by the way, we could, I saw your Joe Rogan interview was 3 hours. We could have used three at least. Go ahead, Melanie.
Well, in the closing, you sent me something that like it is, I love this question. So I'm going to do my best to keep it short here. Reason that I switched the course to what I currently teach now is because I felt like I was failing my students. I felt like I was asking them, most science classes start with, okay, the most commonly used biology textbook for non-majors in the United States, I'm not naming names, is over 800 pages long for a semester. The very first chapter has about 4 pages devoted to the process of science. And the rest of the textbook is all these amazing things that we learned. Now, that's great and all, but facts change. There's different types of scientific knowledge. There's facts, there's theories, there's laws, there's consensus. All of those things are different types of knowledge, and all of them can change. And by teaching students to memorize a bunch of this stuff, it makes it seem like science is this thing where we learn all of this. Like, I'll hear from people online, because I do a lot of science communication online. Well, when science has proven something, then I'll accept it. Well, it's not that easy. And science never proves. Like, our goal is to reduce uncertainty. It is not to prove. Our facts can change. Ask Pluto, right? Our facts can change. So the process is so much more important than what we've learned. And I look back to my students before I changed the class. I honestly think I failed them. I mean, we had a pandemic since then. We had a new virus. We had new vaccines. Do we mask? What kinds of masks? In what circumstances? Like, we had so much uncertainty. And in the midst of all of that, people were confused and they were scared. And when that happens, they retreat to their ideological bunkers, right? I trust these people. And they're not necessarily the best source of information. And yes, the science changes. And when science changes, we update. That's how science works. It doesn't mean it lied to you. It means we learned something else, and that's a good thing. So teaching the process, in my mind, is so much more important than teaching what we learned.
Absolutely. Okay, we got to close it. Again, you can learn more at Mental Immunity Project, all one word, mentalimmunityproject.org. And you can learn more about Melanie's work, which I'm sure you're enticed to do now, at thinkingispower.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencmcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to about 15 articles to flesh out the conversation, email me at TEMcnally, TEMcnally, at macmac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at most of those podcast sites or at my site. You can find years of podcasts at my site or those sites. Van Jones, Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. And finally, thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, Melanie, Teresa King, and Andy Norman, keep up your good work. Thank you.
Thank you.